land use. We will start this morning, first of all, in our work session part, we'll kind of go down to the bottom part of the agenda for House Bills 2431 and 2812. Representative Ackerman.
We need to open the work session.
Oh, we'll open the work session. Thank you. Open the work session on House Bill 2431 and 2812. Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2131 and 2812 in block to the House Committee on Water without recommendation as to passage.
Any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, Representative Ackerman has moved House Bill 2431 and 2812 on block to the House Committee on Water without recommendation as to passage. So done and voted. Okay. We now will close the work sessions on House Bill 2431 and 2812 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2533. Do we have...
I'm right here.
Do we have any further testimony on 2533 as to the amendments? I believe Representative Greenlick has a comment.
Representative. Yes, Mr. Chair. We have an amendment, -1 amendment, that was brought forth, Representative Greenlick. And I'll go check, see if the sheet will say.
Representative Greenlick, you want to tell us about the amendment?
Thank you, sir. You assigned a work group to deal with the issues in conflict on 2533, and the work group was made up of myself, Jim Craven from the American Electronics Association, Associated Oregon Industries, John Lesner, Northwest Propane Gas Association, Lana Butterfield, Pacific Northwest Paint Council, Ted Hughes, Western State Petroleum, Brian Doherty, OEC, Matt Blevin, City of Eugene, Seth Karpinski, DEQ, Bob Danko, and Bob Elfers did some research for the group. We met twice and came to a conclusion that the problem that we needed to solve in the short term was the fact that the propane industry was paying taxes in or fees in one of three fee categories that they probably should not have been, at least at this point. It was a little question of finding out what the problem was, and that seemed to be the problem. There are three fee categories that were established, one for the Toxic Use Reduction Program, one for the Community Right to Know Program, and one for the Orphan Sites Program, and the problem seemed to be a modest one. The group quickly came to two conclusions. One that followed up on what we heard in testimony here, that DEQ really needed to look at the three programs, and perhaps the fire marshal needed to look at the fees, but that the interim would be the proper time to do that, and DEQ is committed to do that, and all parties are committed to helping them do just that. So we expect in the next, in the 73rd Legislative Assembly, to have a coherent review of all three of those programs and the fees that go with them. In the short term, it turns out that the propane people that hold propane on site have been paying about 12% of the taxes, the fees in the Toxic Use Reduction Program, and all the other people in the committee felt that at least between now and the next session it made sense to eliminate that component of their fee. They'll continue to pay fees in the Community Right to Know and in the Orphan Site Program, but our proposal, and it's carried out in the -1 amendments to which all the parties agreed, would eliminate their component of the fee, and the other parties would pick up a relatively small amount to make up that difference. It amounts only to 2% of the overall fees among the three programs, so people felt that was a fair solution, and I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2533 that you have in front of you.
Representative, as soon as we get...
We're not in work session.
No,
we're in testimony. I'm sorry. Okay.
So we will, first of all, the chair would like to thank Representative Greenlick and those that worked on the work group for their very hard efforts in mitigating a solution to this problem. We shall close the public hearing on House Bill 2533 and open a work session on House Bill 2533. Representative Greenlee.
I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2533, Mr. Chair.
We have a motion to move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2533. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? Are there any objections? Seeing none, we will move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2533. And Representative Greenlee.
I move House Bill 2533 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Greenlee moves House Bill 2533 to the floor.
Is there a need for a as a further referral? As amended. With the dash one amendment.
Representative Greenlee moves House Bill 2533 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Zoner.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to give Representative Greenlee the big head, but he did an excellent job on this, and I just want to pass that along to make
thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
Are there any objections? Seeing none, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Greenlee.
Aye.
Representative Doyle.
Excused.
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Zoner.
Aye.
Representative Richardson.
Aye.
Chair Garrard.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, if there are no objections, I suggest I move Bill 2533 to the consent agenda.
We have a clerk, would you again pull Representative Doyle on...
Representative Doyle?
Aye.
And we have a motion from Representative Greenlee to move House Bill 2533 as amended to the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Any objections?
Do it.
So moved. House Bill 2533 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation to the consent calendar. And we shall close the public hearing on House Bill 2533. The work session on House Bill 2533. We'll close that and open a public hearing on House Bill 2614.
Mr. Chair, I received a call from Legislative Council. The amendments to 2614 aren't ready yet, Mr. Chair. The people that have been invited to provide testimony on land use issues are here. Go ahead and Mr. Chris Emily, who is the city manager of the city of Kaiser, is sitting before us, and people from Metro, including Doug Riggs, are also available for comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Chris, you want to... I would advise the committee that when we do receive the amendments to this bill, we will have an additional public hearing to allow any other testimony at that time. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Chair Garrard, committee members. I'm going to excuse myself early. I seem to have caught a second bout of flu that's going around, so if I faint or pass out, I'll try to do it early in my presentation and quietly. As mentioned, my name is Chris Epley. I'm the city manager of the city of Kaiser, City Hall being located at 930 Schmaler Road, northeast in Kaiser. I was asked by the committee administrator to come today as a professional currently practicing in the field of local government and to just share my thoughts with you on the state land use planning system. Generally the impact that it has on local governments and how it relates to economic development. Please understand that the thoughts I'm going to share with you are my own. They don't necessarily represent the opinions of the city of Kaiser. Also, I realize that my points are not necessarily germane to the specific changes being processed through HB 2614, but instead I would like to speak to you more broadly in a general fashion on the state land use planning system in general. So, first, let me say to you that the Oregon land use system, in my opinion, is fundamentally necessary and good. does an excellent job at protecting against urban sprawl and the unnecessarily high infrastructure costs that follow inefficient development practices. It does a very good job of that. Additionally, it protects productive agricultural lands and scenic areas, which are very important for promoting tourism and driving our economy. I do, however, have a specific concern, and that concern pertains to the appeal process as it is currently administered in relation to the land use decisions made by local governments on parcels that are solely within their city limits and that are not designated by agreement as regional topics or issues. Literally, any person, private organization, or agency that participates in any way in a land use process can appeal a local government's decision for nearly any reason, valid or not, whether or not they have a vested interest in the case. Each new resolution to an appeal process through LUBA is also considered its own land use decision and can there be appealed and is subject to all of the notice requirements. This can result in months or years of delays and legal stalemate that can deter private investment in potentially beneficial development projects. In my opinion, the process lends itself to frivolous appeals that have, on occasion, more to do with stalling development ad infinitum than in protecting the valid state land use goals that were adopted by the legislature. This in itself strips municipal governing bodies of any local jurisdictional control that they have in making decisions for the constituents within their boundaries on land use issues. As to economic development, the appeal process acts as a barrier, in my opinion, to attracting new businesses because the process is very bureaucratic and is easily stymied by private interests. It lacks flexibility, which is critical in negotiating with businesses to meet their potentially individual or unique needs when thinking about locating in a community in relation to land use. As a conclusion, as a public administrator, as one who believes strongly in our form of government, I believe that public input is singularly critical and is an extremely valuable element of our form of government. But the current appeal process, in my opinion, is unbalanced, unfair, unwieldy, and leads itself too easily to a tyranny of the minority over the majority. Ultimately, those elected to represent the people of the jurisdiction ought to have the final say over what is best for their constituents, unless, of course, their decisions violate constitutional rights or are unethical. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Appleman.
Yes, I think your testimony is extremely interesting, and I've certainly thought about that as I have, you know, read cases in this area. And I'm not going to speak to this, but are you aware of the recent decision, a 2001 decision? It's I know the name of the first party, not the second party, but it's UTSEY, U-T-S-E-Y, versus somebody.
I'm not.
As which the Court of Appeals substantially narrowed the requirements on a constitutional basis as to what constitutes standing before a public agency for appeal purposes. And just very, very generally in that case, the appellant was the League of Women Voters, and the court basically said they had not sufficient standing, even the legislature couldn't vest that upon them. So you might check that through your city attorney or have them call, because it's an interesting decision, and they provide some help and without a legislative remedy.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Questions?
Any other questions of Mr. Epley? Saying no, thank you.
Chair Gard, thank you.
Appreciate your comment.
Take care of the cold.
The committee will stand at ease while we find Mr. Wiggs, who is also doing another presentation, another committee this morning. So we'll stand at ease for the moment until Mr. Wiggs is available to come.
Some other one testifying, Bill? Maybe that's Wiggs, not a tourist.
You'll hear about it, I expect, in a minute.
This is one of the Okay, we'll call the committee back to order on our public hearing on House Bill 2614. And at this time, we'll say good morning to Mr. Doug Riggs. You're a busy man this morning.
I am, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I just talked to our friends next door about zoo parking lots and taxicab regulation, and we're happy to be here again to talk about land use planning. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to take an opportunity at some point to talk about Metro's role in land use planning and UGB expansion and industrial lands. I know that's an issue that a number of committees and work groups are focusing quite a bit of time on. And Metro is an organization that has been around, approved by the voters back in 1979, several charter amendments that Andy will get into a little more detail. But we really thought it was good, would be good for the committee to hear what we've done recently with regards to the Metro area's expansion of UGB and why we have done so, and specifically what has taken place in which of our three counties. So I'm here to introduce Andy Cattugno, who is probably, if not the foremost, one of the foremost land use planners in the area. Andy's done both land use planning and transportation planning, and he's now our director of overall planning. Andy has been around for quite a while, and is, as I said, an expert, so we appreciate the time. And we don't have any comments particularly or specifically on 2614, but we did think it was important and might be helpful for the committee to kind of get a 10 or 12 minute update on what we've been doing lately on land use planning.
We appreciate the education.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Andy Cattugno, Metro Planning Director. Metro is a government level of government authorized by the 1977 legislature, put into effect in 1979 in its current elected form. We are an urban level of government covering just the urban parts of the metropolitan region, parts of three counties, but then 24 cities within those three counties. The council of the Metro is an elected council. There's six members of that council serving by district, one council president elected at large, and one elected auditor to oversee accountability for the organization. Metro was first formed with elected officials again in 1979. At that time, there were 12 members of the Metro Council and elected executive. Metro went through another phase of change in 1992 with a charter, home rule charter, approved by the voters of the Metro region after a statewide constitutional amendment allowing us to have a home rule charter. And at that time, the council was reduced to 7 members plus an elected executive. And we've just now gone through another change in form where the position of the elected executive officer was combined with the position of the presiding officer of the council into a single council president position. And that council president took office just this last January. And that's our current form. That charter that was approved by the voters in 1992 was really most particularly about the land use functions that Doug referred to, and I'll get into those in some more detail as I go along. But we also do other functions besides the land use planning functions. We operate a regional parks and green spaces system that includes both existing active parks, particularly Oxbow, Blue Lake, parks, as well as a major open space acquisition program. Voters approved a bond measure in 95, and we've now acquired nearly 8,000 acres of open space, over 2,000 acres more than the voters were promised back in 1995. That parks and green spaces system is as much about people as it is about nature, and there's really a strong emphasis in preserving very significant blocks of open space around the metropolitan region. In the planning arena, we cover land use and transportation planning. We are the so-called designated metropolitan planning organization under federal law that requires a metropolitan-wide multimodal transportation plan and involves approval of transportation dollars in the metropolitan region. But within the land use area, we do the single urban growth boundary for the metropolitan region rather than 24 competing individual urban growth boundaries, but also establish an overall framework for where growth is going to go, identifying industrial areas, town centers, regional centers, neighborhood areas, etc. In addition, we operate the solid waste disposal functions of the region. We have two major transfer stations that result in disposing of garbage, but we also have an excellent recycling program with a 55% recycling rate in the metropolitan region. So we do as much as we can to avoid that disposal as well as getting rid of garbage. But we also operate major facilities, attraction-type facilities that the public uses. The zoo is a metro function. Maybe not the zoo parking lot, but the zoo itself is a metro function. Largest paid attraction in the state of Oregon with over 1.2 million visitors per year. The convention center is also metro. Its expansion is opening up this month. We'll nearly double the size of that facility and be the largest convention facility in the Pacific Northwest, providing over $400 million of economic benefit per year with the activity that it attracts. But in addition to those two, we also have the Performing Arts Center, the theaters, if you will, as well as the Expo Center. The Urban Growth Boundary decision that we just finished in December of just last year is really a significant decision that we went through. We went through a major evaluation of how much growth we're expecting in the region, how we're using land now within the existing urban growth boundary, how much room we have within that existing urban growth boundary, and as a result made changes to both the area inside the current boundary as well as expansion of the boundary. Over 18,000 acres of land was added to the urban growth boundary for both housing and job-related purposes. As part of that expansion, we sent direct notice to over 100,000 individuals that could be affected by the decision, and another 100,000 notices through utility bills, plus scads of public meetings and hearings and opportunities to provide input. The actual expansion is shown here, is heavily focused in the southeast part of the region, Damascus and Boring, but all of those little orange spots, if you will, around the periphery were included in the boundary, comprising that total 18,000 acres. That 18,000 is comprised of about 3,000 acres of industrial land. Those are much harder to site because of the land requirements of industry being much more specific than residential requirements. That expansion for job-related purposes is heavily focused on industrial, and the two key parts of metropolitan economy that really needs industrial land is high-tech, such as this site here, the Rondler Acres Intel site in Hillsboro, as well as warehousing, very different kind of land requirements, but both major parts of the Portland metropolitan economy, and both significantly short of industrial land inside the existing urban growth boundary. But as part of this, we also took actions to slow down or stop the conversion of industrial land to commercial purposes. Industrial land, about 24% of industrial land has been historically been used for non-industrial purposes, and so we took action to slow that down. Some of that's appropriate, but not to the extent that has been happening. Like I said before, we also did about 15,000 of those 18,000 acres for residential purposes. That provided space for some 38,000 units. That's about a third of the capacity in our urban growth boundary is through this expansion. About two-thirds is land already inside the urban growth boundary. We also took action as a result of a charter amendment that our voters approved last May to restrict the effect of increases in density on existing established single-family neighborhoods. So we took action to avoid that kind of mandated increases in density, instead focusing that density in town centers and along corridors where it's more compatible with surrounding neighborhoods. I'd like to go through the industrial lands in particular. As I mentioned, we've added 3,000 acres. We still have identified a need for an additional 2,000 acres. And so we're hoping to get the 3,000 acres acknowledged by LCDC within the next several months. But we will be back with an additional expansion to meet the remaining 2,000 acres at some time in the future. The colored areas, again, the blue and the purples, are the various industrial areas. I'll go into them in some more detail around the metropolitan region. This is the southeast side that I mentioned, the Damascus area. The purple areas are the ones that are most suitable for large tracts of industrial land. We've designated that something called regionally significant industrial areas. Those areas that will have the greatest degree of limitation on non-industrial uses in order to preserve those large parcels, particularly the large flat parcels, for industrial purposes. In this Damascus area, there's some 400 acres on the top right-hand corner on the south side of Gresham. and then some 1,100 acres farther south and southeast adjacent to Happy Valley and Damascus for industrial purposes. But in the total area, there's about 13,000 acres of expansion, and our focus there has been to create a complete community for the area, not just a bedroom for the rest of the metropolitan area, not just an industrial park for the rest of the metropolitan area, but a complete community with schools and town centers and the whole package. This is on the south side of the metropolitan area. That's Oregon City, shown there in the southeast corner adjacent to Clackamas Community College. There's some 90 acres of industrial land expansion in that part of the region. This is adjacent to Wilsonville and Tualatin. In this area, there's some 450 acres, mostly west of I-5, in part adjacent. Well, the bottom purple area, if you will, is adjacent to the new Day Road Prison, which moves infrastructure, sewer, water, streets into the area and makes that area fairly easy to serve. The other large one is currently 12th and Sand and Gravel, and so that'll be some time before that converts over to other industrial purposes. Finally, in the Sunset Highway Chute Road area, the purple there in that corner is adjacent to that, or very close anyway, to that Romer Acres Intel site that I showed you before. This is the area where there's the greatest demand for high-tech expansion, and so we've provided 200 acres for that high-tech expansion in that area. We're now moving on with the concept planning for the area. We've also adopted limitations to ensure that that land that we brought in for industrial purposes in fact stays for industrial purposes, because it is so hard to find suitable sites. We want to make sure that that's in fact available for that future industrial expansion. We're now going through the acknowledgement process with LCDC. Part of those industrial lands in fact are up this week in front of the Commission for Acknowledgement. The balance and all of the residential lands will be up in May in front of the Commission for Acknowledgement. We'll wait and see what happens, whether or not any of those get appealed. If for those that don't get appealed, we'll move on to do the concept planning, the comprehensive planning, identifying the infrastructure requirements, amending all the local plans to provide that infrastructure, things like that, in order to provide that land as available, developable land. About half of that industrial land could be readily serviced because it's near existing facilities. The other half will be some time for infrastructure to get out to it before it's available for service. With that, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Representative Greenlee.
I've always valued your advice, so perhaps you can help me understand your process a little bit at this point. My understanding of the bill that you're testifying on, although you're not taking position, 2614, is it shifts some of the authority for establishing residential housing supplies to local communities, I think is what it does, inside Metro perhaps. And I was particularly interested in watching your last process, and perhaps you can talk to me about the difference between technical input into the kind of the planning stage that was just passed in December and the political process, because the question of is going to be political, whose political process ought to be the one. When Mike Burton first presented the plan, it was, I assume, a plan that came out of your technical discussions with some political expertise involved, and then as that plan emerged through a set of hearings and political decisions, it changed. I was watching one particular parcel, so-called Parcel 94, in that which represented 3% of your land supply but 50 houses. And it very much intrigued me how that sort of came out of nowhere and emerged onto a plan, and there were some other pieces that emerged as well through, at least rumors had it, a sort of political horse trading among the members of the council. Could you talk a little bit about how it went from the first plan that was submitted by your executive to what ultimately emerged and the relationship between the technical and the political in that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, the technical process that you're referring to is one that follows state law and requires that these decisions be based upon findings of fact, and the kinds of facts that are relevant and bear on the decision deal with such things as ability to provide services and infrastructure into the area, potential impact on environmental resources, potential impact on agricultural operations, and all of that information was compiled for all, about 100,000 acres of territory surrounding the metropolitan region, from which the 18,000 acres was selected. So all of that information was available to weigh the merits of one site versus another site. Ultimately, however, there's value judgments that get made, and the political elected officials are the ones charged with making those value judgments. That's the job of the Metro Council, to weigh those value judgments. And there's, the facts are there, but there's a matter of degree to which you can interpret those facts. Is it very hard or just hard to provide public services? Are there very good protections for environmental resources, or only adequate protections for environmental resources? Quite a number. Every single one of those factors have degrees of gray associated with them, and it's up to the elected body to make their judgment on what are the right values to that should weigh. But that's also not the final check and balance. There's LCDC acknowledgement required to insert their judgment on whether or not those values were weighed properly, and then the courts after that. The process was one whereby the information was developed and published and available for public consumption, if you will. Then the executive officer made his recommendation. He's not part of the decision-making process, at least prior to this charter change. Now the new president of the council is part of the decision-making process, but at that time the independent executive officer could simply make a recommendation to the Metro Council, and then the Metro Council started a hearings process, much like we're doing today, and received testimony from lots of individuals throughout the metropolitan region, both at, directly at hearings as well as, you know, email, mail, etc. And so more facts were brought to the table as a result of that hearings process. Things that the information that the staff prepared, for example, on infrastructure availability or something like that, may not be totally complete. And so additional information was provided through testimony of the public in that process.
I may follow.
Follow.
If we get to the question of whose political decision, the particular parcel I was interested in is, I'm both interested in it, but it's an example. The officials of the city of Portland came in and testified against including that parcel in the urban growth boundaries, but the political decision, you said, was made by people from Clackamas County and people from other kind of places that were in some kind of quid pro quo trying to protect property that way. So part of the question comes, I think, ultimately, is what's the role of the local elected officials in defining their future, or is it to what, I mean, how do you balance a kind of metro-wide, which I generally support, with the needs and desires of individual city officials for defining things according to how they think their constituents are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, local governments play a very significant role in Metro's planning and decision-making process. And in fact, the charter that I referred to that the voters approved in 1992 institutionalized the role of local governments in that decision-making process and mandated that there be a so-called Metropolitan Policy Advisory Committee, MPAC, as part of Metro's, any land use decision-making that Metro goes through must seek a recommendation from MPAC. The actual drafting of that charter that required us to have an MPAC was carried out through a charter committee that drafted the charter, and that charter committee was appointed by the legislature and included quite a number of local government representatives on that charter committee. So they made sure that they had a voice at the Metro table when they wrote that charter. At the time that charter was being developed, there was considerable debate about whether that recommendation from MPAC would be a binding recommendation or an advisory recommendation. And the decision at that time was made that on certain kinds of decisions it should be advisory, and other kinds of decisions it should be binding. And on land use decisions, it was decided that they had to make a recommendation. They had to be at the table considering all those land use actions and make a recommendation. But because the nature of the decisions that the Metro Council is making is regional in scale, not local in scale, that the Metro Council had to have the independence to take that recommendation or modify that recommendation. On the other hand, the MPAC role also deals with what services Metro will provide. And it required that if the Metro is going to take on a service like the convention center, like the zoo, like the parks system, if Metro is going to take on a service that is already provided by local governments, then the local government committee had to approve Metro taking on that service unless voters approve taking on that service. So that's an example where the MPAC has an approval role rather than an advisory role. Those kinds of functions and interrelationships with local governments were very much debated when that charter was being drafted, and then the voters approved that charter. And since then, MPAC has been a very significant part of Metro's decision making and was very heavily involved in this process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Andy.
Any other questions? I have a couple, Andy, if you don't mind. Does LCDC move in an acceptable timeline in responding to Metro land planning problems?
Mr. Chair, we've certainly been happy with the kind of response we've gotten from LCDC, both the commission and the staff. This process that I just described was a two-year-long process. We were very concerned that we did not have a clear path to follow and needed interpretation on what path to follow in order to ensure that we did it right, and they were quite responsive in providing that interpretation. We just completed this decision in December. We filed it with the commission in January. There was a comment period allowing people to intervene until February 14th, and they're now in, here's March, in front of the commission for approval of some of the industrial lands. They'll be in front of the commission in May for the balance. That's moved pretty quickly through that process. So both the advisory role during the two-year process and now the acknowledgement role has moved pretty well.
What percentage of the industrially zoned property within Metro would you consider to be presently using the term shovel ready?
Mr. Chair, I'd say maybe a third of the industrial land, vacant industrial land, is shovel ready. There's another 35% of industrial activity expansion that happens through redevelopment or expansion within existing plants. So obviously those locations are shovel ready. So there's that third that's in existing plants, but the other third is of the vacant industrial land. Two-thirds is not shovel ready. I guess two-thirds plus this expansion is not shovel ready because it lacks infrastructure, mostly transportation access infrastructure, in some cases because there's a brownfield difficulty cleanup problem that needs to occur, in some cases because of environmental limitations on the sites, in some cases because of parcelization and the need to aggregate land.
And when you look at expanding that and adding more industrial zone property, do you have a particular criteria as you look at expanding and going outside the present urban growth boundary? I mean, what are your main criteria in looking at which way you go and where you go?
Mr. Chair, the first thing we do is to evaluate what kinds of industries are going to be expanding, because different industries have different land requirements. And then once we define what kind of industries are going to be expanding and how much, we then determine what their land needs are, and that's a function of size, parcel size requirements, and there's various kinds of parcel size requirements from small to medium to large, and then site-related requirements, such as generally flat, less than 3% slope, generally access to transportation facilities, and then generally proximity to similar kinds of industry. High-tech tends to want to more locate on the west side of the region. Warehousing is the other major need, generally tends to want to locate in the I-5 and I-205 corridors, more on the east side of the metropolitan region because of the intermodal terminal access on the east side.
I'll just keep going here as long as nobody... Metro obviously must buy into the sustainable community concept when you're moving in the residential area, residential slash commercial.
Very much so. Maybe you could elaborate on what aspects of sustainable development you're questioning.
Well, I'm not really questioning. I mean, that I wanted to see whether it was part of the process. that, that Metro considers.
Mr. Chairman, are you talking about the complete communities idea? Because I think that's been one of the real focal points in the east part, to try to ensure that we create an area and plan for it enough ahead of time that we can provide for roads in areas that are not currently developed, so we don't get into a situation where everything's built before we plan, oh, gee, we needed, you know, a wider road or more sewer or more electrical.
I'm just going to keep on a roll here. When you look at the Portland area, consider that I myself am a rural legislator, and it really takes a new mindset when you're dealing with what you folks have to deal with. What are you up against as far as government-owned land? Obviously, there must not be any.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's far less than, say, if you were in Redmond or Bend surrounded by BLM land. As an example, I think two-thirds of the eastern part of the state is federally owned. I'm not aware that there's an awful lot of land around the UGB. I think the major constraints limiting expansion, say, in Washington County have been farmland, and state law restricts the ability of Metro to recommend an expansion on the farmland unless it's significantly down the categorization list.
Okay. It, Mr. Chair, if you're referring to those kinds of federal and state forest-type lands, it's quite a distance to the Mount Hood National Forest on the east and quite a distance to the Tillamook State Forest on the west. We won't reach those for centuries.
Well, and I know some large cities are actually now negotiating with BLM and other government agencies
to trade
in land trade. And that's what I was curious as to whether that was anywhere on your horizon.
That's not an issue surrounding the metro region.
Okay. I got one more for you, then I'll quit. How is Metro funded? And what is your budget?
Most of Metro's functions, every one of Metro's functions is a unique combination of sources. Solid waste disposal is all through fees. All of the spectator and convention facilities are through a combination of fees, admissions, and concessions and things like that, plus hotel-motel tax. The zoo operation is, again, a combination of fees, admission, and concessions, plus a property tax base. The general government functions of Metro, which includes the council government of, costs as well as planning costs, is an excise tax on Metro's enterprise functions. So anything Metro, in effect, sells to the public has an excise tax associated with it that pays for the general government functions. And then the transportation planning functions in Metro is paid for through state and local and federal transportation trust fund dollars, transportation resources.
Do you have an overall budget figure that...
I can't quote to you the exact budget figure. It's something in the $300 to $400 million range.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none.
Unless they want to talk about my why my constituents can't park at the zoo parking lot, but they're doing that somewhere else.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank you for the opportunity and extend our offer to assist and provide technical information for any of the bills that you're working on.
We appreciate that, and we understand you're neutral on this bill.
We've taken no position on 2614. And understand that there might be an amendment, but we haven't seen the amendment, so we'll take a look at that when we get a copy.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Doug, very much. Andy,
thank you.
Appreciate you coming in. Do we have any further? It's only the invited testimony, so we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2614. And committee, we in the past couple of days have received 14 new bills, and I think we have more coming, and we have somewhere in the vicinity of 50, I think, at this point. So this will be our last morning that I think we'll be getting out of here early. So enjoy it, and we shall adjourn at 9:25 a.m.